probably at his funeral.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 2 minutes after 9 a.m., Friday, February 19, 2010. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, and Senator Egan, and we'll have some other senators joining us later. There's some other committee meetings going on. We also have Senator Pasquin that's joined us pretty much the whole week, and hopefully he'll be here for a little bit next week as we continue on. And Senator Coghill has also joined us. And you'll see other senators come and go through our presentation today and continuing on next week as their time permits. But we'll continue our discussion on production taxes. Here with us today is the Department of Revenue Commissioner. He will provide the committee with an update information requested yesterday regarding tax credits, followed by a presentation on revenue forecasting and a summary of the information we reviewed so far, kind of a recap. Then we'll go on this morning, if time allows, we'll have the Department of Law go over some tax payment penalties, which is another issue facing the state, not only as a receiver, but a payer. And there seems to be a potential issue there that we need to possibly address. So from the Department of Revenue, Commissioner Galvin has joined us. Commissioner Galvin, if you could put yourself on the record and then go ahead and do your, update on yesterday's credits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And what we've done today is I've incorporated the update on the credit slides into a summary and basically a recap and a little bit of an expansion on some of the areas that we've covered so far this week. In putting the materials together, we have been able to provide some information that had been requested earlier, and we're providing it here in a much more expanded format. The wealth of information that's included today, I think, is going to cover the bulk of our time. The information regarding the revenue forecasting is a whole separate discussion that involves comparison with the ELF system, with PPT, and would be a fairly significant departure in terms of the information that we've provided, because we'd have to go back and review some of those aspects. And so we've kind of held that one back today, and we can talk about sort of the pieces and parts if it comes up today, but it would probably not fit into today's time frame. So let me just go through the material that we have pulled together to frame up, once again, the information that you've heard this week and put it into the context of the production tax calculation. If you remember this slide from a few weeks ago when we were doing the revenue overview, we provided you with a sort of a one-page representation of how the production tax is calculated. And really what we've done this week is we've drilled down into the various components of this calculation sheet. We started the week looking at oil price and production outlook, and that really is the beginnings of any production tax calculation. Previously, we had gone through our methodology for projecting oil prices out into the future. Earlier this week, we also talked in detail about the production forecasting method, how we build up from the materials provided to us from the companies, and also covered the outlook going forward about potential opportunities that aren't included in our production forecast that may come to fruition if there is success in the exploration opportunities. And those discussions really capture the top part of this income statement approach. Next, we turn to the midstream or downstream portion of the calculation, looking at the deduction provided for transportation. And there were presentations with regard to how the deductions for marine transportation, the tariff on the Trans-Alaska pipeline, we provided information on the history of that tariff and some of the issues that go into the calculation methodology and why there's been some changes over the last few years related to the tariff itself. This is the part of the calculation for production tax purposes that brings you down to what's referred to as the point of production value, which is sort of the top of the pipe, if you think about it from that perspective. From the point of production, then you back up to the wellhead by deducting what we refer to as lease expenditures. And you heard from the department the exercise that we went through since ACES was developed to draft regulations to define what are qualified lease expenditures, what can be deducted, and providing a clear and predictable method of discerning which costs are going to be deductible and which ones are not. You also heard from our econ section projections looking forward about what we see as it relates to the spending levels from a sort of across the North Slope basis, aggregating everybody together. And what we see is we see growing capital expenditure levels. And again, this is for everybody together. And we see operating expenditures that climbed back in fiscal year 2009 and have come down since then. When we've discussed the spread of capital expenditures, we noted that the currently producing fields are still a majority of the capital expenditures are being spent in the currently producing fields, while the under development expenditures are the most expanding portion of the capital expenditure projection. And that will feed into some of the information that I'm going to present here shortly. So once you've deducted the lease expenditures, both the operating expenditures and the capital expenditures, from your point of production value, that brings you down to what's referred to as the production tax value. And the production tax value is the per barrel value that derives the progressivity rate. So now we're talking about the tax rate that will be applied to your production as an individual taxpayer. And you have the base tax, 25%, and the progressive tax is you start with no progressive tax up to a point of production value of $30, and then from $30 up to $92.50, it goes up at a rate of 0.4% per dollar and then rises above that at 0.1% per dollar. So in this example that we had for FY09, there was a per barrel production tax value of $44.46, which then derives a progressive tax of 5.8%. If the expenditures had been greater per barrel by a dollar, reducing the production tax value by a dollar, the progressive tax rate would have been reduced by 0.4%, would have been 5.4%. So the dynamic that I'm just trying to point out is that as either the price goes up by a dollar or spending increases by a dollar, those will both change the production tax value and the progressivity charge. So next we turn to tax credits. And we provided for you an overview of the tax credit types. And we have the general capital expenditure credits, 20% of all capital expenditures. We discussed the fact that exploration credits fall into different categories, some at 20%, some getting 30%, and some earning 40% credits. Net operating losses, where a company has more expenditures than the production value, results in a credit going forward. The tie credits under PPT were discussed, and the small producer credits that are available for those who are not providing production to exceed the limits of the small producer credit. This is the updated slide with the information that was requested beyond 2008. And the one thing that I'll note here, as I noted yesterday, for 2006, 2007, and 2008 calendar years, and this, by the way, these are calendar years, not fiscal years, so they won't match up to the revenue sources book, for example. The 2006, 2007, 2008 period, we have annual tax returns to derive these numbers from. And so we're able to pull from those each of these categories. For 2009, 10, and 11, we're basing these numbers strictly on our expected level of capital expenditure and taking 20% of that. We do not have information to provide a total for these other categories at this time.
Could you, Chair?
Senator Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we get information on what these capital expenditure credits would be under the governor's proposed legislation later?
Senator Hoffman, with that bill, we will have the information on right. the levels and the breakdown between the different types of capital costs.
If we could, Mr. Commissioner, on looking at the capital expenditure credit, the large one. Later on in your presentation, does it kind of break out Prudhoe-Kuparik versus, you know, any effects of potentially Point Thompson or, you know, other fields out of the core cash cow basin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Do we have a full breakdown of those different fields?
And just for a brief comment for those watching at home, these presentations are being put together almost in real time by the department. So, you know, they come in the morning and we fire right off. So this is a fairly fast pace. So, and I do appreciate the department working to, you know, add this additional information for us, and so we can stay on our schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, last thing, just to note, as we indicated earlier, as you'll see, the trend on the capital expenditures continues to rise as we look into the future based upon what the companies have provided us in terms of their expected spending levels. So, expanding on the credit discussion from yesterday, what we wanted to do is discuss in more detail how the credits are used, and it depends upon the taxpayer's own situation, whether they're a new entrant, whether they're an incumbent with existing production. And so to kind of walk through the credit experience of those two, we're just going to take a couple examples, and these are not intended to represent actual taxpayers. It's just an example to show the difference in the experience of the two. So if we imagine a situation where you have a new entrant who currently has no production and is looking to pursue an exploration project that requires a $200 million investment. Once they've made that investment, the company will receive either a 20, 30, or 40% credit, depending on the location of the exploration activity and its proximity to existing wells or to an existing unit. And that credit is worth, right off the top, between 40 and 80 million, depending on which of those categories they qualify for. In addition, because the company has expended $200 million without any revenue, they have a tax loss of $200 million, which when you apply the tax rate of 25% against that, results in the net operating loss or tax loss of 25%, which is worth another $50 million tax credit for the following year. So between the different credit programs, the $200 million investment results in credits of between $90 to $130 million. And these can be directly recouped for cash from the state if the company meets certain requirements, or they can be transferred to a person that does pay the taxes. And that person will take the credit certificates and reduce their taxes by either 90 or up to $130 million. So either way, the state is going to pay $90 to $130 million of the $200 million investment. So the company will be responsible for the remaining, either $70 or to $110 million. So just to note that this applies regardless of the success of the exploration project. It's not dependent upon actual production resulting from this investment. The state will not get the money back if it's an unsuccessful venture. And so the state bears the risk of failure, as does the new entrant. So this slide represents the investment on a dry hole. Yesterday, Mr. Chair, you asked, you know, what's the share that the state has in a dry hole development? Just to note, my staff tells me that this represents the homeless elves that have been seen running around the North Slope for the last couple of years. I don't quite get the reference, but as you can see from the cost of drilling the exploration well, as in this example, the well is drilled in a location that qualifies for the 40% exploration incentive credit, when added to the net operating loss credit. The state's share of the cost is 65%. In addition, the company can expense the cost of the well on their corporate income tax at the federal level, which will result in basically 12% of the cost being a savings to the company on their federal income tax. And so in this situation where you have a exploration well that qualifies for the exploration incentive credit, the company will pay 23 cents on the dollar for that exploration well. Turning now to the experience of an incumbent producer. If they have a $200 million investment, and just to note that this says a development, some of the examples in here I picked up subsequent would only apply to an exploration play, but just to note that. The company would receive a 20% credit for a development project that's a $200 million investment, so it would be worth $40 million. And this is where the calculation gets a little complicated and gets a little particular to each taxpayer, because this next calculation will depend upon the individual taxpayer's situation as it relates to their particular production tax value. Every taxpayer is going to have a different portfolio of properties that's each going to have a different volume and per barrel cost. And it will be the mix of that portfolio that will result in that particular taxpayer's overall production tax value per barrel. But with the $200 million investment, they will be reducing their production tax value by that $200 million, thereby reducing their base tax by an amount that equates to 25% of that investment. In addition, because they will be potentially sliding down the progressivity scale by reducing their production tax value, they will also save on the change in the progressivity as it applies to all of their production, not just what might result from this investment, but all their production will enjoy a reduced tax rate because of that change in the progressivity charge.
If we can just pause there for a minute, Mr. Commissioner, one of the statements you just made slips by a lot of people most of the time, and that's progressivity applies to all barrels produced once it's triggered.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned earlier,
Well, that's fine. You can go on with your presentation.
Just right.
Clear that it covers all of them.
And you'll see, actually, in a couple of examples as we go forward, how this impacts different taxpayers. So the production tax credits for an incumbent, when we take the $200 million investment, is going to be greater than $90 million, depending upon, again, that progressivity impact. So the state is paying 90 million of the $200 million development cost. If the development fails, the state does not recoup any of that money, and again, the state bears the risk of failure, as does the investor. So taking an example, and this is where this should reference an exploration project, because there's an assumption in here that they are qualifying for the exploration incentive credit. So this would be an exploration project similar to the dry hole that we described earlier, but if it were pursued by an existing producer. So the state share is going to be greater than under the experience of the new entrant because of that progressivity impact. And in this example, and you have to look down in the fine print, which is sort of like the mumbling at the end of a commercial, but assuming that we have a $70 wellhead value, you end up with a 9% progressivity rate, which results in the state's share of this investment cost being 76%. The federal share is reduced because there's less of a deduction at the federal level than for the new company. But at the end, just looking at these numbers don't add up.
If we could, while you're...
I think it's a rounding, considered a rounding error.
If we take a look at this and we wanted to ballpark this, if the exploration incentive credit was not available, because it was obviously, with infield drilling, could we then just ballpark it by backing out the 40% on the state share? Or how would we get a ballpark?
If you wanted to ballpark that, you drop this from 40% down to 20%, and which would reduce the state share down to 56%. The federal share would then increase up to, 35%, to about 15%. Which would then result in the company share going up to about 28%. Yeah. So the range in this example, giving a producer who is experiencing a 9% progressivity, is that for every dollar of new investment they make in a well, their share is between 15 and 23% of the actual cost.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So going back to slide 12, that is the reason that we see increases to in the numbers to $1.6 billion from 2006 to 2011, particularly because the existing producers have when they drill, the state is picking up the vast majority of the exploration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is that?
Well, I think it's one of the issues of this session is the question of the attribution of what is causing certain behavior. And I think that what we're trying to demonstrate here is that while the state revenue is increasing, which means the tax burden on the industry is obviously increased, that the state has basically distributed that impact in such a way that those who are investing in new exploration and development in the state get a tax benefit. So we are trying to simultaneously bring in some additional revenue while also incentivizing the behavior that we're trying to encourage, which is creation of more jobs and more production.
And my statement is that looking at the top line capital expenditures going from $195 million in 2006, except for a million dollar decline in 2007, this number is continuing to rise. In 2009 to 2011, we're seeing an additional $130 million of that the state will be picking up, so that it seems to me that the incentive is working, because the we see a dramatic increase from 195 million in 2006 to a projected 384 million, close to a $200 million increase from 2006. So it seems as though the incentive to me is working.
It would appear that way, yes.
Just want the record to reflect Senator Thomas has been with us for quite some time.
I had a question.
Okay, I just want a little clarification. Exploration and development versus how does infield drilling in Prudhoe Park fit into exploration and development in the definitions?
That would be considered a development expenditure.
Okay. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that same page 12, we have 09, 10, and 11, but we're talking about calendar years, correct, still here at this point?
Correct. On slide 12, this is calendar years.
So, but this slide at least appears to me to be credits applied against tax liability. How do we know 10 and 11? This is not supposed to be an estimate. I thought this was what was actually historical, or what's happening, or is the shaded area then estimated?
The shaded areas are estimated because what we receive is we for 2009 and the first part of, well, actually we haven't gotten the first one of 2010 yet, but we'll receive a monthly report. But the monthly report isn't as detailed, nearly as detailed as the annual report, and so we don't have the breakdown of what actual credits have been applied. So we have to take the information they provide us in a different format with their projections of their spending levels to then anticipate where their credits are going to be used and applied, in what periods they're going to be applied.
Okay, thank you.
And just to note, if you remember from yesterday's presentation, there is a distinction to be made between when the credits are earned from when they're applied, because of the two-year lag, and also for net operating losses, they can be applied the following year after you've experienced the loss. And so this slide is replacing the slide from yesterday about what periods we expect the credits to be applied against production, against. And again, and one last clarification, just because yesterday I think it also may have not been clear. This is a slide representing the taxes applied by producers. Producers being a term used for those who are currently taxpayers. So it does not include the credits that are earned by those who do not have current production that will result in either a request for the state to reimburse them for their credit, or a transferable credit that will actually be applied by someone else in an amount greater than what you see here.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and continue. We're on 19.
Yep. There you go. So turning from the credit discussion to looking at the overall share of oil revenue, this is something that we also were asked about. This slide represents the allocation of revenue that's generated from a barrel of oil at a $76 price. So this is $76 West Coast price. And so you start really at the bottom with the production and transportation costs, And if you think about our income form, we start with reducing it by the transportation costs to get it to the point of production, reducing the lease expenditures, and on average, we tend to move somewhere around $24, $25, $26 in the combination of those costs. Then you have state royalty, generally 12.5% off the point of production value. So it's not off of the wellhead or production tax value. The 12.5% is calculated on the point of production value. So you only reduce it by the transportation costs generally. Then we have the production tax, the state corporate income tax. Little sliver here is the state property tax that's shared with local governments. We have the federal income tax that would be applied to the producer. And then the remainder is the after-tax value for the company. So when we break this down, we have it broken down by dollars. So these dollars represent their portion of the full 76. We also separate it for discussion purposes between the taking off the costs and just looking at the profit, the after cost profit, and how does that then get divided. And so the percents that are represented by each segment are the percent of this $52 in profit. So royalty makes up just under 17% of the profit, production tax just under 24%, state income tax about 5.5%, property tax is less than 1%. The federal income tax is about 18.5% of the profit, and then the producer's portion of the profit is just over a third.
Mr. Commissioner, on the production tax, that includes a progressivity calculation?
Yes, the production tax would include both the base tax rate and the progressivity.
So
the state.
Hold it.
Oh,
Senator Hoffman.
So we go back to the first page. It's 34.4% of what number would be their profit? Under the 68, I know that there's the difference between 76 and 68, but you'd multiply that 34.4% on which line? On page
on
2.
Hold on one second.
Let's have a brief at ease. Back on the record. Mr. Commissioner, if you could help us with that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue that we have is, first, you have to take off the royalty barrels. So if you are comparing the percentages, you would first deduct the cost and the royalty to get your production tax value. And then the production tax would be the progressivity component, as I mentioned earlier. But this band represents the after credits portion. So that's why the percent of the profit is less than the tax rate times the $43 that remains. And so it's the combination of the 25% plus the progressivity, and then you subtract the credits that would result in this $12.50 or 23.8% of the profit.
Just a subtle point, I think the commissioner's making, the net effect or the netting out of the credit a lot of times is not taken into account in a lot of the high level calculations in the tax structure when we just add progressivity and base tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and that's you know, oftentimes for us when we're trying to compare different charts, we have to be sure that we're recognizing whether it's above or below the line in terms of the credits, and this one where the credits are incorporated into the calculation itself.
Okay.
So
go ahead and continue then with your presentation.
From this example, again, this is just at $76 per barrel. And again, it is a generalization across the entire North Slope, for as an example, given current spending levels, credit levels, and so forth. And this would represent the state share of the profit being 47% of the profit at that that price and those expenditures. So then looking at how that changes based upon the nature of both the royalty calculation method and the production tax method, what you see is that low prices, the percent of the profit that represents the state share is higher. And this is a function of the royalty being regressive in nature, in the sense that it is a percent of the production tax value or the point of production value, not taking into account the cost. And so at the lower end, the royalty ends up driving the state share higher. As you get to the upper end, the progressivity element of the production tax then drives the state share higher. And the slide represents the change in the share between the state, the federal government, and the producer as you move along the potential price level. Now, this slide represents the sharing of the profit. So it does not take into account the costs that are having to be paid in order to get to that profit. So when you look at the share of the revenue that's generated from the oil, the first thing you have to note is that where take doesn't reveal the fact that the producers are going to recover their costs first. And so when you look at the percent that's going to the producer in order to cover their cost and then derive a profit, You can see it provides a different picture of the distribution of the revenue as you move up in price, and that the cost recovery dominates the share at the lower prices and becomes a lesser and lesser part of the revenue split as you move up in value.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would it be possible, or maybe it's here and I'm just not seeing it, to produce a chart similar to one of these two on 22 or 23 that would show the investment that the parties make in relationship to the dispersion of revenue? So if that makes sense?
Yes. Senator Thomas, to the chair, I actually had a slide in there and I took it out at the last minute because it seemed disjointed. But
okay.
If you think about some of the charts that you've seen that show, for example, the marginal tax rate or the marginal government take, these are charts that generally show the marginal government take accelerating significantly up to the $92.50, where it's hit about 90% and then it drops off. That slide would represent kind of what you're talking about, which is the share of the dollar of investment that is borne by the state and the federal government versus the producer when the price is at a different point. And so from that, you can derive that when the price is approaching that $92.50, the state and federal government share is approaching 90 to little over 90% of that investment dollar. And we can provide that for you as well.
I think that would be helpful. For me, it would anyhow. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, one of the questions you've asked throughout the week is how does the production tax differ in the different fields of the North Slope? And so what we've tried to do here is to go through that same kind of income statement approach, and we've separated the North Slope fields into three categories. The first category being Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk alone, just the two of them. The second category that we'll get to is all producing fields other than Prudhoe and Kuparuk. And then the third category is going to be non-producing fields. So the numbers that you see here are what we've tried to go to great lengths to say are estimates, rounded estimates of what 2010 may look like for these fields. They are not intended to be specific dollar amounts that we would expect to see on their tax return, because again, they're rounded in their estimates. And also that these are aggregating the production tax impact by field, not the way it's actually done, which is by taxpayer. And so when you think about the players on the North Slope, each one has a different combination of interests in these three categories. And it's going to be their individual mix that will result in their particular production tax value, their particular progressivity rate, and the value of the various credits and deductions. And so that's why we're caveating this as much as we can, but it does provide you, this exercise does provide you with a sense of the proportionate share of various parts of the production tax experience between these three types of fields. So, starting off, our current official forecast for FY 2010 is $66.93 West Coast price. Current production estimates for these two fields is about 488,000 barrels per day. So results in $32 billion in value. That's $32 million per day, which is the equivalent of $11 billion, or almost 12, annually in value. Taking off the federal and any, there wouldn't be, I mean, the royalty, there wouldn't be any federal barrels here, but royalty barrels results in taxable barrels of, that have a value of about $10.5 billion. Rounded transportation costs reduce that by a little less than $1 billion. Lease expenditures, about just under $10 per barrel operating expenditures, about $6 per barrel in capital expenditures, result in a production tax value total of just over $7 billion, which equates to about $45.61 per barrel, resulting in a progressivity rate of 6.2%. And the total taxes being derived before credits of $2.2 billion. The credits here, what we've done for simplicity's sake is to take the amount that we have expended up here and just take 20% of that. Again, that's not going to be the experience because of the lag time and so forth, but they have credits from the previous year that are going to be fairly similar, so it's not that, it shouldn't be that far off. So the after-tax revenue, tax revenue generated from Prudhoe and Kuparuk is estimated to be just over $2 billion. So next, going through the same methodology for the other producing fields. So this is all the producing fields other than Prudhoe and Kuparuk. Same method, we just have less production to result in the taxable barrels on an annual basis of $3.5 billion. Same transportation deductions, just under $300 million. Lease expenditures, operating was actually similar to the Prudhoe at almost $9.5. Operating's higher. I mean, capital's higher, operating's similar. The production tax value for these fields then is lower, primarily because of the additional capital expenditure per barrel, resulting in a lower progressivity rate and a after credit taxes due of about $528 million. And then the last example is going to be the non-producing fields. And it's primarily Point Thompson, Nikaichuk, and NPRA. NPRA being the Alpine satellite potential development. So there's no production. So there are no costs on a per barrel basis associated with transportation, but there are expenditures associated with this operation, and those result in a negative production tax value. So if you take 25% of that, you get what would be the equivalent of a net operating loss if this were being incurred by a new entrant. This is a combination of entities. So some will be taking this loss and applying it against their revenue generated from the other fields. Either way, it's going to result in at least a 25% reduction in our tax bill. This is sort of a minimum look, assuming that everybody only gets 25% as opposed to any progressivity advantage. So it would result in a carry forward credit of about $243 million. In addition, you have the 20% of these capital expenditures. And so from these fields, it ends up with a net reduction in production tax of about $433 million. So this slide just provides some of the information in a single page to kind of summarize and compare. And so what you can take away from this is that we have most of our production and most of our tax revenue is generated from the two big fields. No surprise there. The operating expenditures are fairly similar on a per barrel basis between the big fields and the other fields. And again, this is average across all of them. Some are going to be higher. The capital expenditure level is...
I guess as we work through this the last few years, you know, we get a little more information all the time, you know, it's quite the learning experience. But I just assume that Prudhoe and Comparic, relative to the other non-producing, would actually get some synergy and have lower operating costs too. But why is the operating costs so close with the high volume old infrastructure of Prudhoe, Comparic?
I think it's a combination of things. I think that the operating expenditure level for a field is going to hit sort of its lowest level at its peak of production, you would expect. Prudhoe and Comparic are not at that point anymore. They're on the downward decline. And so I think it's just the combination that some of the fields that fall into the other North Slope producing are closer to that most efficient production time frame, and they balance out some of the others. And so it ends up, and actually I share your, this is the first time I've seen it presented in this way myself, and I am also surprised that it came out to be so close.
And then if I could just jump to capital expenditures, thinking back to the original PPT discussions and how much capital investment we were trying to encourage to stabilize our decline in production was, I think, an additional billion, or basically a doubling of the capital expenditures, as I recall. I guess I'm not, I don't know if the capital expenditures in Prudhoe and Comparic is approaching our potential targets of the original PPT trying to curb the decline. That's something I probably want to go back and look at the record and see what those discussions were and resources. But I remember we spent a lot of time talking about how much as far as a capital infusion into Prudhoe Comparic it's going to take to stabilize it, regardless of all this other stuff going circling around the tax system. It needed more investment.
Mr. Chair, that's right. We're looking for more investment. We're looking for opportunities to incentivize that investment. And I think, as was noted in the earlier comments from Senator Hoffman, we are seeing behavior in that direction. I think what this also reflects is that the level of investment is not necessarily spread evenly throughout the fields. And so I think that the slides provide an interesting comparison of the different fields, noting that of the 2.1 billion of production tax, that's at the end of the day what you see here in this committee in the form of the line item at the top of the budget. It represents a basically a reduction of 400 million, which almost equates to the amount of tax being generated by the producing units other than Pruitt-Igoe Park, which is a interesting reflection of how the state's participating in those investments. So as this particular week, we'll kind of take advantage of it being a Friday and use it to kind of look back over what we've covered and then look forward at what's coming next week. We've tried to cover the building blocks that provide a foundation to understand the production tax and the different moving parts and how they relate to each other. We've focused exclusively, because we are at this point almost exclusively an oil province, on how oil production tax is calculated. Next week we're going to look beyond Alaska and say, okay, now that we've kind of seen where our government take numbers are, where the investment incentives are, how does that compare when we look at other similar provinces around the world? And then we're going to move into a discussion of how does the current production tax perform when it's an oil and gas production basin, as we would hope to be in 10 years. And we'll talk in, I think, great detail about the interaction of gas into the calculations that we have shown you thus far. So with that, Mr. Chair, that kind of wraps up this presentation. And we have with us Department of Law to discuss the penalty issue, if you wish to move to that.
Yes, we're going to move to that in a minute, and I don't know what your schedule is, but you may want to hang around for that or have a representative from the Department of Revenue.
Oh, I'll be
presentation
here.
Okay. I'd just like to make a couple of comments on the presentation today. I know we all get better with practice, and something so convoluted and confusing as production sharing arrangements. I think the presentation today of the kind of an income approach, laying out the tax, and then when you moved on to your slide 4, where you called out particular section step by step, and then gave the kind of a watermark slide of how those tied in, is very helpful. I think it makes it a lot clearer. And I know there's several steps within this top-down calculation that were left out for clarity purposes to get the concept across. But I think this is going to be very helpful for the legislature and the public, when they look through this, because there's a lot of moving parts, and we're going to add a couple more next week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your help in helping us visualize how to present this as well.
Any questions for the commissioner before we Okay, well, thank you very much, and we'll move on now to our next presentation. And we'll ask Department of Law Assistant Attorney General Susan Pollard to come forward. We'll have a brief at ease while we set up. On the record, and if you could put yourself on the record and who you represent and take us through your presentation.
My name is Susan Pollard, last name is P-O-L-L-A-R-D. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oil, Gas, and Mining Section here in Juneau, the Department of Law.
Could you maybe pull the mics in a little bit? And we don't want to miss anything you're going to tell us.
Okay, is that better?
This expensive proposition for us.
All right, thank you very much. I help the Department of Revenue on this presentation just to cover tax penalties. So you'll see in slide 2 that there's just a general overview of what I plan to cover. And that would just be a brief overview of the general tax penalty provisions in Title 43, briefly address compromise and settlement in that area. And then we'll segue directly into some provisions that just apply to production tax. So before we continue, I just want to make sure that that is about where you were planning to go here. I'm guessing that isn't okay.
Yeah, I'll stop you when we get, or if we have questions, I'll just wave at you.
That'll work. The general penalty provisions for Alaska for the production tax and basically for many taxes under the Alaska statutes are found in Title 4305, which is the administrative section of the tax administration. And the production tax has some specific penalties that we'll be getting to. This particular slide mentions that when there are disputes over tax penalties and compromises of tax, that's first handled at the departmental level. So much of that is not in the public view. And when there is a dispute or an appeal, the appeal is also handled under Title 4305. And those would go, first of all, to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So that would sort of be the first procedural step if there's a dispute over the amount of a penalty. We are on slide 4. The basic penalty would be the one that you find in 4305-220, which would be the failure to file or failure to pay. And the failure to file is fairly obvious because that would be somebody failing to, or a taxpayer failing to, timely file their tax return. And as you can see, it's a 5% for each 35 days up to 25%. And that would also apply if a tax return is filed, but it is not actually, the amounts are not actually paid, just as the report is given. That penalty is imposed with the guidelines of the regulation, which is 15 AAC 05-200, where a taxpayer can set forth reasons that they may have had a reasonable cause for delay and failure to file a tax return. As you can see, the state's regulation specifically incorporates some federal interpretations, and it's the IRC 6651. So in that sense, the state is using federal guidelines to determine the appropriateness of, you know, when the factual situation would allow for penalty assessment. The second standard under that particular statute would be the negligence or intentional disregard penalty. I believe that's probably Section B of that penalty. And that would be the situation where you have a taxpayer who is really underpaying a return, a more negligent underpayment situation. And that would be an additional 5% penalty added onto that. As you can see, the standard is a little bit higher for that. And what's listed on the slide is a paraphrase of the regulation. So it would need to be determined before the assessment of this additional amount of penalty would be that there was a substantial deviation, you know, a lack of attempt to really comply with the Alaska statutes and reporting income, exaggerated deductions. And this would be very similar to what you'd see at the federal level for that type of penalty. And then the fraud penalty, as you can see, is a much higher penalty where it could be greater than 50% of the tax deficiency or $500. And that is a much higher standard and really a fraudulent attempt to evade the tax. And I don't recall if there's any Alaska case law on a fraud penalty, although we do have some Alaska Supreme Court guidance on when failure to pay penalties are allowed. And then the penalties are cumulative. So if you've failed to pay up to 30 days, up to 25%, and if the failure to pay was due to negligence or intentional disregard, there'd be an additional 5% added to that amount. And then the next slide that we are covering here, and so far where we are, we're not on anything specific to production tax. We're just on a general revenue. Mm-hmm. This would apply to corporate income tax. And then the criminal penalties are, you know, willful tax evasion. That's where you're actually getting to potential felony or Class A misdemeanor action. And so, of course, at that point, different agencies besides the Department of Revenue would be involved because you would be making a criminal prosecution for a tax penalty. Or, you know, an absolute willful failure to evade, to present false information to the Department of Revenue. And so it is definitely a difference between the prior civil penalty where you could have an exaggerated deduction. You know, people sometimes are creative, but to actually get to a fraud level, you're at a definite willful criminal intent level. In Alaska, our compromise and settlement of tax and penalties is handled in 4305070, which would allow the compromise of a tax or penalty.
Senator Egan, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, I'm just curious. We're talking about fairly large corporations here, so who goes to jail?
If a criminal,
is it the person?
Is it the tax auditor?
It hasn't signed the form, or
yeah, just let her. Yeah, let her answer the question. Go ahead.
Senator Egan, I don't know the answer to that question right off. I've never done a criminal penalty one. That's certainly something that would be easy to figure out from looking at IRC provisions and just case law. I can certainly get you that answer.
Mr. Commissioner, you can help us with that.
My only observation that I'd provide is that in other instances where you'll have criminal action against corporations because of violations of other laws, It's only in instances where there is an individual who actually has been identified as culpable in breaking the law that you would have somebody going to jail, but a corporation can be subject to other criminal penalties, you know, probation and other things associated with their behavior, and obviously fines and so forth that would be imposed as criminal penalties as well as being civil penalties. So it's not necessarily the case that somebody's going to go to jail anytime that there's a criminal action against them.
Go ahead and continue.
Think of the Enron situation where you had a little bit of both there.
Mm-hmm.
The compromise of a tax or penalty is also covered by statute. And in, as you can see in this statute, a compromise of a tax or penalty in some situations requires the Department of Revenue to make a determination that this is a particular case that would be good for settling, and that the tax should potentially be compromised, either because there are issues of, you know, clarity in the law. Sometimes collectability is an issue. And in that kind of situation, the Department of Revenue and the Department of Law work together to determine the compromise. Usually the way it works is the Department of Revenue does the legwork and then comes to the Department of Law with how they want to approach this particular taxpayer. Then the Department of Law does sort of the same thing and looks at the particular tax, and they come to an agreement that works for a particular taxpayer. And as it, and that just applies to taxes and penalties. Sometimes we've been asked, well, what about interest? This statute does not apply to interest. It's the tax or the penalty that is looked at. Each side looks at whether the particular assessment is going to hold up, if there's issues at the tax brought up that should be compromised. But interest is handled separately. These agreements are final, absent fraud on one of the parties. And then very often they're confidential under 4305-230, because they're very often done at and after perhaps an audit, and then a tax issue would be at an informal appeal level, and that's often when you'll see a settlement. There are situations when the state enters into large settlements where the taxpayers in the state agree to basically a press release that's describing what's happening with the settlement, because people notice when there's a few $100 million going into the state coffers, and that's something that the state and the taxpayer work on. Did you want to say anything about that?
No, just one example that may come to mind is about a year or two ago, we settled a income tax case against a taxpayer for almost $500 million, and that we were able to agree to disclosure of certain aspects of it as part of the announcement of the settlement before the deposit was made into the Constitution Budget Reserve.
And so, of course, as a result of that, you know, the policymakers are getting an idea of what's happening. The taxpayer confidentiality is protected, but there's adequate disclosure about what's happening with the settlement. This has been the week on production tax, so now we're segueing into a couple provisions that apply only to the production tax. And both of these provisions deal with reporting, because in 4355030, taxpayers, or not just taxpayers, but producers are, even if they don't have tax liabilities, are required to file an annual report. And that report is quite detailed about of what it needs to include. And I believe this was a PPT with some additions in ACES as to how the actual reporting got done. We'll just look here at the end of 030. That section has a separate penalty provision, which is if a report is not filed timely, and this is, we're talking about the annual report here, not the installment, the monthly installment payments. But if that annual report is not timely filed, the department can assess a penalty of up to $1,000 a day. That would be the maximum amount of the assessment. And there's some leeway for how the department would determine a particular assessment. This statutory provision had a regulation adopted last year, and that's 15 AAC 55840, that explains to taxpayers how the production tax penalties are going to be administered, so it would give taxpayers some guidance. Because this is a fairly new, and that particular regulation, I believe, is effective sometime in the fall. It might be in the October register. Because it's a fairly new regulation, I did include most of the regulation in the next slide. There's a few ellipses that take out a little bit of it just to make it a little more readable. But in promulgating this regulation, the department was protecting the statutory need to get the reports with the kind of information that the legislature set out as necessary, and yet also provide a little bit of leeway for, say, perhaps a new explorer who maybe didn't read the text quite as carefully and maybe didn't realize that they too also had to file an annual report. So this regulation recognizes that in most instances the department is going to be notifying a taxpayer within 30 days that their report is late, that they're subject to a penalty. And if that taxpayer doesn't get the notification in 30 days, then the department will notify them, your report is late and we're giving you until this amount of time to get your report in.
And just to pull this back into the discussion that we had earlier today, the importance of getting these reports really can't be underestimated given our ability, our desire, and I think your desire, that we're able to provide you with information similar to what we've talked about this morning in order to understand how the production tax is functioning and the behavior of the taxpayers in response to it. We need to get this information from them in terms of where they're spending, where they're currently spending, what they're deducting, and under what provisions they're deducting their credits. And that's why there is this additional penalty for not providing those reports, because it's not just about giving us an amount that through an audit some years later we're able to verify. It's the fact that we need timely information in order to be able to understand how the tax is functioning and whether or not we're getting compliance across the board.
Okay.
Yeah, just to confirm what the commissioner was discussing, my slide 7, I shortened up a little bit what's in subsection 1A of 4355030, but the commissioner says is, I mean, there are 9 subsections of the type of information, and you know the slide presentation that the Department of Revenue just did uses quite a bit of this type of information that's requested, so it really is a useful tool, I think, for all concerned. The second production tax specific penalty is in 4305040, and this particular statute, it's not an annual statement that we're talking about, but a situation where the Department of Revenue just needs more information from somebody engaged in production, a purchaser of oil, gas, or a royalty owner to provide information necessary to compute the tax. And the department is allowed to ask for this particular information. Usually the information will be held confidential, but it's the type of access to information that the department may need in certain instances to really figure out what's going on, because they're trying to compare all these different reports and different information from different areas. So this is something that doesn't always happen, unlike the prior statute, where there's always going to be an annual turn. There's nothing that definitely keys onto this section. This won't always be applying. But if the department does determine that it needs additional information, it we send out a request to the taxpayer, and if the taxpayer fails to comply, then the department does have the ability to impose a penalty under subsection D. Once again, it's up to $1,000 a day. This section is a little bit different because the penalty would not kick in until notification to the taxpayer, unlike the prior provision where the department could impose a penalty prior to notification, just if a report was late. So that's really the main difference between those two sections is the timing on those two. For both of those sections, the regulation goes on to set out things that the department will consider when it's determining whether a penalty should be assessed or not for a particular failure to file information. So that includes whether, you know, the taxpayer's action, was it just an omission, a new entrant who for some reason didn't realize they needed to file an annual return, willful or knowing, and we're not talking about the criminal level here, but just the type of considerations that would help the department determine whether a penalty is something they want to do in that particular situation. Whether there were any benefits to the person in the failure to file, whether this is a continuing problem, is this a particular explorer or producer that the department's always having issues getting timely information, the need to deter future noncompliance, which is fairly common in the penalty world, the types of things that the Internal Revenue Service would look at too, and the efforts made by the person to correct noncompliance. So this provides some discretion to the department to determine whether a penalty would be appropriate. It also provides notice to the taxpayers of what types of standards that the department is going to look at in determining the appropriateness and the amount of a penalty. So in summary, like other taxes, there are general failure to file and failure to pay penalties if the tax laws are not being complied with. Within the production tax world, there are some additional penalty provisions if the department is not getting annual reports with the information it needs and it's not getting any additional information that the department has specifically requested. The regulation that applies in the production tax area, just on the production tax, is the 1586-55840, and that would be for both the 4355-030 and 040 penalties are taken care of in that one regulation. Okay. And that is the end of my presentation and general overview of the tax payments and penalties.
I think that one of the issues that we have and why this was put on the agenda, dealing with our tax, our oil tax structure, we have one case coming to the state where we have to pay a substantial amount of money on a legal case. It's not oil and gas, but it's in the tens of millions of dollars in interest. This could be the flip side in the oil and gas arena where, you know, we are the collector of a particular settlement, and there's some concern that there isn't enough flexibility within the system when a taxpayer is to their best ability is filing on time and submitting the appropriate tax to the state, but there may be a difference of opinion in the end as far as what is paid. There seems to be a kind of a rate of interest that is not very flexible, and maybe one of, I don't know who to exactly direct the question to, either the Department of Law or the revenue, because it's a legal question that deals with revenue. So maybe one of you guys can help us with that situation, how the interest rate is locked down. Is it compounded monthly, quarterly, annually? And where does the settlement go?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'll start by saying that I apologize that interest rates were not included in the packet, because I had thought that we were going to cover interest rates, and I apologize I hadn't actually looked through. I think that you raise an important point. I think the interest rate discussion warrants a separate presentation, because it does have subtleties in both directions in terms of both overpayments, underpayments, what the rate is, and when is it imposed, and what is the flexibility with regard to a waiver or settlement of an interest rate imposition. And what we'll do is we'll prepare a presentation for early next week that would just focus on that, if that's acceptable.
Yeah, and we could do that, and then kind of, rather than go over the ground we went over today, maybe we'll just boil that right down to the interest rate issue and the inflexibility that is given in statute to the Commissioner of DNR and yourself as Commissioner of Revenue, and the potential benefits of loosening that up to not only the state, but the other party that we're dealing with, in this case, the oil industry, and how to deal with that. And maybe we can keep that fairly succinct.
We'll have it
coming at us, because we'll have a whole plateful next week. But it is an important issue, and the settlements do go to the CBR, and it's less fluid than the general account and the ability to operate the state on a day-by-day basis.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'll bring that information forward. Okay.
Do we have any questions for Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember asking at one point in time previous year that for every dollar that was spent in a lawsuit, and I believe it was just lawsuits, not settlement agreements, that we recovered $10. Is that a statistic that you keep, or was somebody just aware of what it was at that point in time?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
The question is, do you keep the statistic? Because at one time we were told that for every dollar the state spends on a lawsuit, they recover $10, and I was wondering if that was a statistic that you carried forward, or if that was just something that somebody had to go and research and look up. I wouldn't want to create any more work for anybody, but just off the top of their head, if it was still an accurate number.
Another way of wording that, I guess, to lighten up the end of the meeting, are you a profit center for us?
Right. Through the chair, Senator Thomas, that's something I can really direct to my supervisor about how the department law statistics are kept in that area.
Okay. They can get back to us with that.
I think I understand the point of the question. But.
And any final questions for Department of Law or Commissioner of Revenue? Okay. Well, thank you for coming forward and preparing that presentation. I guess this is the first time, as I recall, you've been to the Senate Finance Committee.
It has, yes.
Yeah, well, welcome to the Senate Finance Committee. We're a friendly lot, most of the time. What we're going to do is go on to, this concludes our labor today, so we'll be concluding here in a moment, but next week we'll start at 9 a.m. Monday morning. We'll run 9 to 11, but just like everybody to kind of pay attention, the schedule gets kind of convoluted next week in that we have our operating subcommittees going on at the same time. So Tuesday and Thursday, we're in the afternoons. We'll be in the mornings also, but in the afternoons, instead of starting at 1:30, we'll start at 2:30. 2:30 to 4, and depending on how that flows out, we may not have a Thursday afternoon session. On Wednesday and Friday in the afternoons will be 1:30 to 3 as normal, but so I guess the critical time change, first one up will be a Tuesday in that afternoon, but I'll try to help everybody remember making announcements on the floor and stuff. We just, have a lot to do. We got to keep our operating budget subcommittees on schedule, and we've got to get through this particular issue here by the end of next week. And we're also looking at bringing a few bills up next week also, so we can have keep up with our bill work. So we'll see everybody back 9 a.m. Monday morning. Meeting adjourned.